Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, May 16th, 2024. Peggy Fonseca fired from role as Jeff Davis County EMS Chief by Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Fort Davis. Peggy Fonseca was fired from her role as the Jeff Davis County EMS Chief by county commissioners this week and escorted out of the courtroom by law enforcement following a period of political turbulence set off by EMS budget issues. Fonseca's employment with the county was discussed in a commissioners' court meeting this week in public session at the request of Fonseca. The back and forth, which mostly saw Commissioners Roy Hurley and Royce Laskowski confronting Fonseca about her leadership failures, ended in a vote in which Hurley, Laskowski, and as well as Commissioners Jody Adams and John Davis chose to terminate her employment, with County Judge Curtis Evans opposing. Evans told the Big Bend Sentinel the commissioner's decision to terminate Fonseca was a knee-jerk reaction that wasn't thought through well enough, and he opposed the move because there are so many programs and grants she was contributing to in the works. This situation has hit an abrupt wall. It's going to take a lot of work now in my office in order to continue with these programs, Evans said. Evans named himself the administrator of record to help keep the service running for the time being, and a replacement for Fonseca will likely be pursued, he said. We're going to keep the payroll going. We don't want to shut our service down. It's too vital to our community and our people. We need this service. Fonseca told the Sentinel she felt a mixture of relief and disappointment at being fired, and she didn't believe the decision was fair. She also expressed doubts the service would continue in her absence. It was a witch hunt. That's all it was, Fonseca said. That witch hunt is going to cost them the loss of a service for a community that will never get it back. Fonseca began transitioning into the role in July 2022 after the retirement of longtime EMS Chief Vicki Fowler, who chose to step down to make way for new leadership who could help transition the previously all-volunteer service, the only remaining in the Tri-County area, into a hybrid or paid service. Fonseca hit the ground running and began hiring paid EMTs and paramedics and became involved with several countywide health care initiatives, including the idea to pursue the construction of a federally qualified health care center and more telehealth services. She also served in a volunteer capacity as the county's emergency management coordinator. Her employment first came under fire from concerned citizens as well as county officials, including Laskowski, in October of 2023, when she received a notice of violation from the Texas Department of State Health Services, DSHS, for failing to provide life-saving measures to a person in cardiac arrest. Fonseca contested the violation and ultimately entered into a settlement agreement with DSHS that required her to complete 3 one-hour continuing education courses. She remained employed by the county while the legal process played out, and Evans maintains she was doing a good job on behalf of the county. More recently, issues emerged with the EMS budget, which is overrun due to employee overtime expenses, Evans said. The court voted to allocate more money to the department to ensure employees continue to be paid, but the issue emerged as a sticking point during discussions about Fonseca's employment. When prompted to explain why the department was so over budget this fiscal year, Fonseca said volunteerism within the service has declined within the past 5 months, with volunteers dropping out due to family issues, injuries, and more, leading them to rely more heavily on paid staff. She also pointed out volunteers were sparse before she arrived, with many aging out, and call volumes are currently high. The EMS wheels are still going round and round. We're still making calls. We're still very busy. I cannot give you what I don't have, Fonseca said. The whole reason people volunteer is they volunteer when they have time to give to the community. Commissioner Hurley took issue with Fonseca going out on ambulance calls herself, to which she said she had to because there was no one else to fill in. He said volunteers told him they decided to drop out because they didn't like Fonseca's leadership. Every volunteer that I've talked to, it's the leadership. That's what it comes back to every time, Hurley said. I've met with the volunteers, too, and they've all said they left because of you and your leadership and your policies, Laskowski added. They all said the minute you are gone, they will be happy to come back to work. The two commissioners also expressed concerns that Fonseca was not being aggressive enough in her communication with volunteers to get them on the schedule. Fonseca expressed confusion about which volunteers the commissioners had spoken with and said she does send emails and texts to try and fill up the schedule. Melanie Blackman chided, "This is poor leadership," from the crowd. Fonseca called her fake news in reply and maintained that volunteerism was down even before she arrived. This is not a leadership problem, Fonseca said. Regarding volunteer objections to her policies, Fonseca said she was enforcing state policies, ensuring ambulances were properly checked and patient reports were being done. It's not something I arbitrarily created because I have nothing better to do, Fonseca said. Hurley then turned to Fonseca's overtime hours as a point of contention. He said she was working too much overtime and that the amount from September 25th to March 24th totaled nearly $27,000. Fonseca told the Sentinel Hurley's numbers were incorrect. He said he was confused as to why she was not exempt from earning overtime as a county employee. Fonseca explained that, per federal law, when an exempt employee performs 20% of the job of an hourly employee, they are entitled to overtime pay, and that they had gone back and forth with the Texas Association of Counties, TAC, human resources representative, about the matter. After some more back and forth, Commissioner Laskowski made the motion to fire Fonseca, which was met with claps from the audience, and asked law enforcement officials to escort her to her office where she could collect personal belongings and turn in keys and county property. Fonseca told the Sentinel she felt like she added value to the service and claimed accusations against her were not based on factual information. Everything anyone said was incorrect, Fonseca said. I adhere to grants, unlike other people, and I play by the rules. Evans, who recently penned a letter in the Jeff Davis Mountain Dispatch detailing options for keeping EMS funded, which include subscriptions and an interfacility transfer service, said it remains to be seen how the county will keep EMS up and running. He said he is working with staff to find a solution and to see if any of the volunteers who said they would come back actually will. Everything's kind of up in the air right now, Evans said. We're going to figure out how we're going to fund it. Staff photo by Sam Karras. Musician and artist Kali Ryan, one of the original organizers of Voices from Both Sides, performs a bilingual song celebrating the Big Bend borderlands. Where Dreamers Go, bi-national crowd gathers for annual Voices from Both Sides festival. By Sam Karras, Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Note, the Mexican town of Manuel Benavides, Chihuahua, is often referred to as San Carlos. Lajitas. Last Saturday, over 100 locals gathered by the river for Voices from Both Sides. Every year, there are dueling bands, copious amounts of barbecue and well-stocked coolers, and few dry eyes as people from South Brewster County and the Mexican side of the Big Bend join hands across the river. The Voices from Both Sides festival is also sometimes called the Fiesta Protesta, or Protest Party. Since the river became a border, there were numerous informal crossings along the Rio Grande in the Big Bend that allowed people to go back and forth for work, school, and basic supplies. After 9/11, the American government cracked down, closing every local crossing point except for the Presidio port of entry. The policy was devastating for towns like Paso Lajitas, where locals found themselves suddenly unable to cross for groceries and fuel at the trading post within eyesight of the little village. People with jobs that were once a bumpy truck ride across the river had to hand in their notices, now faced with an 8-hour commute through Presidio. The Terlingua CSD baseball team, whose main rival was San Carlos, had to hang up their uniforms. Kali Ryan, one of the people who brought Voices to life, remembers the days before drones, game cameras, and hefty criminal charges came to the border. She used to spend time with friends on a ranch south of Paso Lajitas and found it difficult to keep connected after the crossing closed. It was heartbreaking for everybody, she said. Around 14 years ago, Ryan brought beloved Terlingua musician Jeff Hayslip to San Carlos, where they visited with then-presidente, or mayor, Ramon Garcia. Garcia had an idea. What about reuniting San Carlos, Paso Lajitas, and Terlingua to do what these communities do best, namely making music and having fun? Ryan Hayslip and a dedicated band of locals from both sides of the border joined forces to throw the first Voices Festival, which followed roughly the format it does today. Small stages on each side of the river traded musical performances while people hung out in the water, freely crossing back and forth for food, drinks, and catching up with long-lost friends. During Ryan's latest Voices performance, she addressed the crowd in a mix of English and Spanish, capping off with a song that repeats its chorus in both languages. The song follows her own experiences on the border. All of my life I've been living a dream. The movies don't even come close, the bilingual chorus goes. There's always one last frontier where dreamers go. Word of the dream spread, and the festival made headlines around the globe. Voices even got the Comedy Central treatment, with a correspondent from Full Frontal with Samantha Bee stopping by Lajitas to mock conservative hand-wringing over the state of the border. Ryan said she understood why people were so taken aback by the spectacle. Two communities coming together peacefully, defusing popular media narratives of a tense and unruly border with laughter, song, and prayer. The world is starving for something real, she said. But all the publicity started to make the organizers worry. They wanted the celebration to remain small and local, with no space for either end of the political bell curve to take the message out of context. At its heart, The event was about reuniting South Brewster County families, not about flipping the metaphorical bird at the U.S. border policy. To this day, the festival does relatively little advertising beyond Facebook posts and word of mouth. There were few tourists in Saturday's crowd. Most came from within the greater Tri-County area, and a small handful came from the village of Boquillas in Coahuila. Presidio High School junior Mario Leyva joined the festival from the Mexican side of the river. He and his family were visiting a rancho outside of Paso Lajitas for Mother's Day and decided to stop by the party to see what it was all about. The family had a leftover Mother's Day cake that they decided to bring over to the American side to share. Leyva was tasked with carrying the cake and carefully maneuvered down the riverbank with a rope that had been put up to help people keep their footing in the mud. At the end of the rope, he fell, but I saved the cake, he said. Getting a little wet and muddy didn't spoil the fun. Leyva felt moved by the end of the celebration, where everyone in attendance joined hands in a giant circle linking the two countries. It was a really nice experience, he said. People should go not just for the party, but because it feels good to reunite, to get along. Early voting begins Monday for area runoffs. Tri-County. Early voting kicks off Monday and runs through Friday, May 24th, for the May 28th party primary runoffs. In Presidio County, voters will decide who to elect for Precinct 1 Presidio County Commissioner between Deirdre Hisler and Samuel Sanchez, and Precinct 3 Commissioner between Tibergio Butch Acosta and Frankie Ortiz. All are Democrats, and with no Republican challengers in November, the winners will assume office in January. Hisler, now retired, formerly was West Texas State Parks Regional Director, and Samuel Sanchez owns a cattle importing and trucking business and the Presidio Stockyards. Presidio County voters must live in the precinct for that race to be eligible to vote. Check with the Presidio County Clerk at 432-729-4812. For questions on eligibility. Early voting will be from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. in either location. Marfa Activity Center, 302 South Highland, or at the Presidio County Annex, Building B in Presidio. In Jeff Davis County, two Republicans will be in a runoff for sheriff, Victor Lopez and C.W. Stevens. With no Democrat contender in November, the winner of that race will assume office in January. Stevens currently is serving as a Jeff Davis County deputy, while Lopez moved from being a deputy there to the Marfa Police Department when he decided to run for the office. Also on the ballot will be a Congressional House District 23 runoff between incumbent Tony Gonzalez and Brandon Herrera. Voters are reminded to bring a proper form of identification. Those requirements can be found at www.votetexas.gov under the Voter ID FAQs.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, May 16th, 2024. More jobs, bigger tax base, coming with potential clean hydrogen plant. The regularly scheduled city council met on Monday, May the 13th. A quorum was established, with the only missing member being Mayor Paul Casillas. Hodges led the invocation, and Warnock led the pledges. The council entered directly into proclamations, endorsing May 15th as Peace Officers Memorial Day and May 12 to 18 as National Police Week. The council also endorsed May 1925 as National Public Works Week and May 27th as Memorial Day. Councilman Falcon said of the Public Works Proclamation, "The freeze of 2021, we were the only city in the state that was affected by the freeze that had the water, sewer, gas, trash, all functioning. Thank you." The council also recognized and memorialized the recent passing of former Mayor William Lannan on April 22nd. The council then moved to the public hearing portion of the meeting, where it entered petition and application requests. The first request from Duff Real Estate to consider annexing 5.5-acre tract of land out of Section 23, Block 146, which shall be zoned as Commercial District C for the procurement of utility services. Next was an application request from Pacheco and Cynthia Pacheco to consider a specific use permit for the replacement of a manufactured mobile home in District SF4, described as being adjacent to 14th Street and State Street. The last public hearing covered an application request from property owners Hernandez Itux Isabel to consider rezoning lots 4, Block 163, Orient Addition, and lots 1 to 6, Block 118, Orient Addition, from a neighborhood service district or general retail to a one-family dwelling district for reflect existing use. The council then approved ordinances for these three requests, then transitioned into petitions, with EDC Director Ramos providing an update on the Economic Development Corporation. In regular business, the council approved the request to consider proposals for the management of the Fort Stockton Convention Center Theater. The council approved the city's request for bids for bulk fuel and lube services, and the request for bid for the repair and renovation of the city streets North Rio and West Hornbeck. They've approved the bid from West Texas Contractors for the construction of a new landfill drop-off station. There was a bid for Agenda Item 21 for the construction of a new standpipe pump station. This item was rejected by the council. The council approved Agenda Item 23, a cooperative purchase agreement between the City of Fort Stockton and Omnia Partners. Council also approved the Memorandum of Agreement between Pecos County, City of Fort Stockton, and the FSISD pertaining to the Standard Response Protocol Program. They approved payment for the service maintenance contract for a John Deere tear wheel loader from Yellow House Machinery. Items 26-27 approved payment to Little Regina Trucking for paving Ryan Street. Finally, the council approved moving the city council meeting to Tuesday, May 28th due to Memorial Holiday. The executive session began and the council met behind closed doors at 6:39 to deliberate regarding the Second Amendment of the Blue Ridge Farm Lease Agreement between the City of Fort Stockton and BioCatters, LLC. The council reconvened in open meeting at 7:17 and discussed the purpose behind the need to update the Second Amendment to Blue Ridge Farm Lease Agreement. The agreement extends the term of agreement to 30 years with two 10-year extensions. This agenda item was approved. The council then approved the water purchase agreement between the City of Fort Stockton, BioCatters, and Apex Clean Energy, ultimately for the production of clean hydrogen. The next meeting of the City Council will be on Tuesday, May 28th. County Talese Railroad Freight Warehouse to EDC. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court met on Monday, May 13th. Perry provided an invocation and the court jumped to the agenda items 4, 17, and 18 to expedite the meeting. Item 4 had the court consider acting upon a memorandum of understanding between FSISD, the City of Fort Stockton County, that seeks to enhance the safety and security capabilities of FSISD by accepting standardized vocabulary and emergency response protocols and simplify school drills. Motion passed unopposed. Item 17 and 18 provided updates to the court relative to emergency medical services upgrades in Fort Stockton and Iran. Item 17, the court approved a bid for additions, renovations to Fort Stockton EMS station, primarily using funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. The winning bidder was Oprex Construction. The bid includes funds to install air conditioning in the ambulance bays. Item 18, there was only one bid for renovations to the Iran EMS station. The bid was from Frontera, which the court concurred was overinflated. Agenda item 18 was tabled with the understanding that JSA Architects would work with the contractor to bring costs down. The court then returned to the listed agenda items and approved the minutes of the previous meeting. The court then moved to the next items. Item 7 was a request by the Chief Juvenile Probation Officer to purchase a vehicle through Buy Board to be paid by state grant funds. Motion carried. They approved an art mural for the east side wall of Schuster Baseball Field at just the cost of materials. They approved an agenda item allowing Precinct 3 to enter a cooperative purchasing program agreement with Purchasing Cooperative of America, streamlining purchasing processes. Item 10 saw the court approve the request for unclaimed property capital credits for counties. They considered approving a contract for a Canon Image Runner Advanced DX copier for the county clerk's office. They approved items 12 and 13 to be paid with precinct funds through the Purchasing Cooperative of America. According to Perry, the current lease with Toro is unsustainable. Items 14, 15, 16 all had court consider bids for surplus scrap metal and tin roof panels in precincts 3 and 4. County treasurer then presented a financial report and payment of the county overtime. Pecos County auditor then provided line item transfers and budget amendments, the financial report, and accounts. The court then went into executive session with the veteran service officer, and then the court adjourned. The next scheduled meeting is for May 28th.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, May 9th. School board members clash over board appointment procedures. Two seats open for applicants. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. The retirement of two Monahans Wicked Piute ISD school board trustees was on the agenda of a specially called board meeting Tuesday evening at 5:15 p.m. in the administration building boardroom. The retirements of District 2 Raymond Reyes and District 5 Bobby Almanza sparked a heated discussion between board members. Board President Donna Garcia opened the retirement agenda item with the statement that Reyes had rendered his resignation, which was effective last month on April 16th. Quote, Mr. Reyes had searched for his replacement for quite a while and wasn't having much luck because really, nobody wanted anything to do with this. I talked to a few people myself, and they were not interested at all, so he did finally find somebody, Garcia said. At this point, Steve Tuxhorn was recognized to speak. Quote, I'd like to talk about this. I have talked to numerous people, not in the thousands, but dozens of people, about this, and the people have some trust issues with the school board and the administration, and they think we pack the school board. I would like to propose that we post those two positions, District 2 and 5, for a month in the newspaper, on the school digital social media, and if you don't get any interest, well, I don't know, but maybe it will help the perception in this in the community, if nothing else. Maybe make amends in the community, so they know we don't just handpick somebody to put on the board. I would like to have it posted for a month just to see if we get any response, Tuxhorn said. Garcia interjected her opinion by saying, quote, Mr. Reyes and I have been discussing this for months, looking for people actively. I looked for people, didn't find anybody. The person I did find wasn't any longer living in that district. I trust Mr. Reyes that he found somebody that was willing, she said. Quote, I didn't say I don't trust him. Maybe he found somebody who was interested, Tuxhorn said. Garcia came back with the statement that if somebody was interested, they needed to contact the board. When Tuxhorn pressed the issue of posting the positions for the public's knowledge and consideration, he was told by Garcia, quote, we don't do that. That's not usually what we do, end quote. The reply to Garcia was, quote, according to board operating procedures, we are all supposed to be presented a list of names, and as a board, we are all supposed to look through that list and pick names out of that list, discuss it, and talk about it, and then vote on it as a board, Tuxhorn said. This drew negative comments from Garcia and board member Steve Fine. Quote, what's the rush? Why are we in a hurry? Tuxhorn said. To which Garcia said, quote, actually, we are. We need new board members on the board in time to go to the leadership conference, end quote. Tuxhorn pointed out that the board has 180 days to fill the positions according to the laws governing the process of filling unexpired terms of school board members. He also said that in about three different places it is stated that a board can post an interview as a board. Quote, whatever, I am just trying to tell you that from the community, not 1,000, but dozens of people have told me they don't trust the school board or the administration and feel like the school board gets packed with the people that they have handpicked. I'm not saying that's a fact, but I'm just telling you that's the perception in the community, Tuxhorn said. Steve Fine raised the issue concerning becoming a board member by stating you have to be elected to the board. But this is not true if a person is being placed in an unexpired seat. Quote, the term of the person being replaced would have to be served to termination, and then if the person picked to fill that seat wanted to continue serving, they would then have to run and win an election to continue as a board member, end quote. Tuxhorn was pressed by Garcia and Fine to name the person he had been approached about being on the board. Quote, I want to give him time to process all of it. He needs some time to think about it. I am trying to represent the people of the district. There could be someone out there who doesn't know about an open seat who might be interested. They need the chance to act on it or not. I would like to change the people's perception of this board by posting the open seats and showing them we are being honest by giving everyone an opportunity to become involved, Tuxhorn said. Garcia expressed her feelings on the rush to fill the seats, which centered on maintaining a quorum. A full board is 7 trustees, with 5 being present to make a quorum. Quote, we can't wait 1 month, Tuxhorn asked. Quote, then we would have to cancel the hotel rooms reserved for the conference scheduled for the 14th or lose the $1,000 deposit, Garcia said. Steve Fine, District 1 trustee, was not in favor of waiting a month while postings for the open positions are made public. Quote, we have the community all mad and saying we handpick everybody, but nobody wants to do anything. Well then, show some interest by running, Fine said. Tuxhorn came back saying, quote, but the community does not know that there are 2 vacancies on the board. I'll bet 99% of them are not aware of this, so let's not rush this. Put it in the paper and post it elsewhere. If you get 0 people, then the community can't complain. We tried to give them a chance. End quote. A motion was made by Tuxhorn to post the two open seats for trustee for Districts 2 and 5 in the newspaper, along with posting on the MWP ISD website for a month. Quote, I don't want it for that long. Let's split the difference and go 3 weeks. That will be 2 weeks before the training conference, and we can still attend the conference, Fine said. Superintendent Chad Smith joined the discussion as a non-board member, pointing out that if the board gives a 3-week posting period and someone has to be accepted, then time has to be spent with interviews, which will extend the time period for acceptance. Quote, I'll go for posting 2 weeks in the paper, Fine said. Garcia called for a vote on the motion of posting for 2 weeks. Almanza, Tuxhorn, and Upchurch voted yes without hesitation. Fine reluctantly voted to approve the motion. Quote, I won't vote to approve, said Garcia. The meeting was then adjourned. If you are a resident of District 2, you can be considered for the open seat of retiring board member Raymond Reyes, and anyone who lives in District 5 can ask to be considered for filling the seat of retiring board member Bobby Almanza. Anyone interested in becoming a MWP ISD school board member should contact the school administration office for the information on how to proceed to the next step. Upchurch retains District 6 seat. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans Wicked Pyote School Board District 6 incumbent Nancy Upchurch was re-elected to the seat during Saturday's election, defeating challengers Christian DeAnda and Krista Powell. District 6 has 998 registered voters, of which 217, or 21%, voters cast a vote. Upchurch received 117 votes, or 11%, while DeAnda received 65 votes, or 6.5%, and Powell garnered 35 votes, or 3.5%. Quote, every election is determined by the people who show up to vote. With any election, I believe that your voice is within your vote. I appreciate all those who took the time to go and vote. Whether you voted for me or Krista or Christian, thank you, Upchurch said of her re-election win. Early voting, a combination of mail-in and early in-person voting, produced 123 votes, with 40 for DeAnda, 12 for Powell, and 70 for Upchurch. On Election Day, votes were cast for DeAnda, 25, Powell, 23, and Upchurch, 46. In order to be declared official, the votes were canvassed on Tuesday during a special school board meeting, and Upchurch will be sworn in during the June school board meeting for another 3-year term. School board elections are held every 3 years. District 2 and 4 will be up for election in 2025, and the election for Districts 1, 3, and 5 will be held in 2026. School board hears complaint against superintendent. Parent alleges Smith clocked at 93 miles per hour by cell phone. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahan's parent has filed a formal complaint against MWP ISD Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith after he was allegedly driving at a high rate of speed while transporting her child from a golf tournament to a softball game on March 28th. Samantha Fuentes filed a grievance against Smith directly after the incident and had her Level 3 grievance hearing in front of the school board on Tuesday night during a special meeting. School board members present for the meeting were Donna Garcia, Bobby Almanza, Steve Tuxhorn, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. Normally, once a parent files a grievance, it begins with Level 1, which is a meeting with the campus principal. If the parent did not receive a resolution at level 1, or if the time for a response has expired, the parent may file a level 2, which is a meeting with the superintendent. Because Fuentes' complaint was against Smith, she began at a level 2, but Smith could not respond to the complaint, therefore it was pushed to a level 3, which is a hearing with the school board. The board may give notice of its decision orally or in writing at any time up to and including the next regularly scheduled board meeting. Fuentes told the board Smith was transporting her daughter from Hobbs, New Mexico, to Andrews in a school vehicle, and a trip that should have taken a little over an hour to complete took only 47 minutes. Quote, according to the Life 360 app, vehicle speeds during the drive reached 93 miles per hour, so you won't have to do the math. It calculates to 16 minutes off the drive time, she said. Life 360 is a location-sharing app that anyone can use. Parents and children can use it to track the whereabouts of family members. Its features also include geofencing capabilities, so you'll be alerted if a family member leaves or enters a designated area, if someone is driving, and driving speeds, as well as one-tap emergency alerts that can notify you if any of your family members need help. Fuentes was led to believe Coach Cameron Schwarb was transporting her daughter to the softball game, but after talking with Schwarb, she was told Smith was the driver. Quote, I questioned Smith on whether he knew how fast he was driving, and he told me he may have went a little fast, she said. Fuentes asked Smith to clarify what a little fast was to him, but said he couldn't. Quote, I told him he reached speeds of 93 miles per hour, and he told me he didn't think he went that high, Fuentes said. After Fuentes showed Smith screenshots from the Life 360 app, which records the highest speed of a drive, Smith told her he never looked at the speedometer. Fuentes also questioned Schwarb about the speed and asked him if he noticed the speed. Quote, Coach Schwarb said he was getting things in order for junior golf and wasn't aware of the speed. I told him it was unacceptable, and he told me Smith was the superintendent of the school and our district, she said. Fuentes said she was infuriated that someone in this position would put her daughter's life in danger. Quote, as educators, we hold the kids responsible for their actions, but when it comes to the superintendent, he isn't held responsible for his, Fuentes said. Smith apologized for speeding and said he couldn't take it back. Smith further explained to Fuentes he was speeding to get Schwarb back in town to see his wife's 100th softball win. Quote, I don't know if that is an acceptable reason for y'all, but to me it is not. He had plenty of time to watch the end of the game and congratulate his wife, she said. Fuentes told the board the school vehicles are not equipped with GPS and are not tracked. Quote, anyone who can speed in a school vehicle and not get caught. Smith said he thought of himself as a safe driver, and he only sped to pass other vehicles, and there was no oncoming traffic when he passed, she said. Fuentes said everyone needs to be held responsible for their actions, and Smith should be held to a higher standard as the leader of his district. Quote, he is in charge of teachers and students to make sure they are safe every day. If he would put a child's life in danger behind the wheel, how can we as parents trust he is giving the right guidance as the leader, she added. Once Fuentes finished speaking to the board, another parent, Rebecca Kynes, addressed the board under the public comments section of the meeting. After Kynes introduced herself, she said, it has been 1,268 days since November 16, 2020, which is when I presented a Level 3 grievance before this board, which I have yet to receive a response for. I surely hope that you will give Mrs. Fuentes more respect than you have given to me and many others who are still patiently waiting on what we know will never come." End quote. Kynes told the board she was there to reiterate what Fuentes said about accountability. Quote, "I am aware of the level of accountability that our children are held to. We have children who are punished for talking too loudly while walking the hallways of Parkway that include things such as extra laps on the playground, missed recesses, or silent lunch periods. We have children who lack the ability to take themselves for haircuts being issued SAC, such as Mrs. Niece's son, because we are holding the children accountable to a dress code, albeit discriminatory and illegal. We also have children who lack the ability to pay Chromebook and cafeteria charges, threatened with having to set out the end-of-the-year activities because they are being held accountable to the delinquency of those charges, although it is ultimately the parents of these minor children who do not do their part. These are just a few examples of how this district has set a precedent to accountability. Where we lack to hold accountability is when it pertains to those of you sitting at this table in front of me. Board members have a lack of accountability to their constituents by refusing to be accessible to them for communication. There is a lack of accountability in unnecessary and inappropriate comments made by individuals on this board regarding students and their parents. We know you said them, and you know you said them. Unlike you, I will at least stand here in front of you to say what I think. Chad Smith sits with this board as the superintendent of the school district. Chad has repeatedly lied to parents regarding policy and procedures, myself being one of them. When called out on it, he denies his words, and when faced with recordings of those words, he says, "Never mind, that's just water under the bridge." Chad has repeatedly lied to members of this board by providing false information regarding grievances. Chad has made the members of this board vulnerable to state and federal lawsuits, as well as prosecution. Chad intentionally circumvented the Open Meetings Act by splitting the quorum to prevent open comment on a topic that is not only a hot topic, but near and dear to many parents of this district. Chad then, upon a Freedom of Information request by the newspaper, failed to fully disclose the full content of a group text message of this board, providing his intent to circumvent the quorum. That group communication is another illegal move by this board. Thanks to Nancy Upchurch for being the only reasonable person on this board with a conscience for coming forward with that information. Now you sit here and listen to a parent tell you that Chad blatantly disregarded state law and driving at a rate beyond excessive. I do not have access to district staff policy, but I am certain there is a policy that forbids speeds of that nature when transporting students or while driving in a school vehicle, period. However, most importantly, he put this child's life in danger, something that cannot be easily fixed with an "I'm sorry." I don't believe for one moment he is sorry he did it. I believe he is sorry that the parent found out. How many times will this board sit by and keep giving attaboys to someone who clearly does not have this district or its students' best interest in mind, while holding the ultimate position that should? How can we continue to hold other staff and students accountable, but fail to hold Chad and members of this board accountable? Most of you currently or have previously held jobs in the corporate world. I am certain you would never let an employee continue to lie to you and fail at their job and continue to hold their employment. You are his boss. Take accountability for your position and start holding him accountable. Lastly, I ask once again that you educate yourself on the grievance topics that come before you and start holding yourself accountable. Once Kynes finished her statement, District 3 school board member Donna Garcia offered a reply, and after a brief pause, Garcia said, "We have listened to us being called names, we are disengaged, do not know what is going on, and are not accountable. But I've been on this board 20 years and never had an opponent, and there is a reason why." Garcia said the reason was not because she is ineffective, disengaged, or not relating to her constituents. "I would challenge you to talk to anyone in my neighborhood. We live in a democracy, and that is great. Anyone who wants to run, go for it," Garcia said. Garcia said being a school board member isn't easy. Quote, "We don't do this for fun, because trust me, this is not fun. This is hard work. We deal with the state who is taking our money as fast as we can get it, if not faster," she said. Garcia said the board was accountable to the students, staff, and community, and if people didn't believe that, to step up and run. Quote, "See how accountable you can be. Educate yourselves on recaptures, and contact your state representatives and congresspeople and questioning them on school finances," she said. Garcia said her goal is to get people to come to the meeting and stay, not just leave after their child is recognized. Quote, "The meetings are not fun and can be boring, but this is the stuff as we as a board have to deal with. Before I got on the board, I came to meetings regularly because I wanted to educate myself and felt like it was something I should do," she said. Kynes made one more comment saying, "Believe it or not, I am a huge supporter of this district, and when I ask for accountability, I am asking for accountability to the policy you have." At the end of the meeting, Member District 1 Steve Fine said, "Do we need to address monitoring the vehicles like putting GPS on them, or should we wait until everyone is here? I do think it needs to be addressed at the next meeting." Smith said he would get with Garcia and get the agenda details for the meeting. Union Pacific unsure why train derailed. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. An eastbound Union Pacific freight train derailed last Wednesday afternoon, although officials have yet to determine what caused the derailment. The train derailed around 3 p.m. May 1st, about 1.5 miles east of Pyote. According to Robin Teisfer, Union Pacific spokesperson, approximately 35 train cars carrying mixed freight, including auto racks, were involved. No one was injured, and hazmat was not involved. The track has been repaired, and train traffic has resumed, but cleanup and removal of the damaged cars continue. The cause is currently not known. Teisfer said the incident remains under investigation. In August 2014, 13 cars of a Union Pacific freight derailed at the County Road 135 crossing in Barstow when the eastbound train struck a full water tanker truck. Union Pacific also suffered two major freight train derailments within 2 weeks in May of 2018. The first was caused by a train striking a loaded water truck at a crossing in western Ward County, and the second was 13 days later when two Union Pacific trains collided near a switching area on the west side of downtown Monahans. About three dozen cars derailed in that accident when a mainline train sideswiped the second train, which was unoccupied and parked on the siding. Roy Hurd Memorial Airport named Airport of the Year. The Roy Hurd Memorial Airport was named the 2024 Local or Basic Airport of the Year by the Texas Department of Transportation's Aviation Division during the 42nd Aviation Conference on April 24th through 26th in Galveston. City Manager Rex Thee accepted the award from Don Harmon, TxDOT's aviation director, who shared with the evening's audience a brief history of the airport as well as its recent improvements. Quote, "We are excited and honored to receive the 2024 Local or Basic Airport of the Year Award from the Texas Department of Transportation, recognizing the many accomplishments and improvements to Roy Hurd Memorial Airport," they said. "Having a viable, safe, and comfortable airport to support the diversified aircraft and flyers in the oil, gas, and sand industries, as well as support services, businesses, and private citizens, is important. The city accomplished an impressive series of improvements to Roy Hurd Memorial Airport over the past 5 years, making Roy Hurd just such an airport, and that work continues. I want to thank the Airport Advisory Board, made up of Henry Cutberth, Cecil Dane, Mike Harbin, Vance Moore, and Ronnie Montague, along with fixed base operator John Cutberth and former FBO Greg Gregory for their expertise and guidance, and Assistant City Manager Frank Heslin for his determination and persistence dealing with the federal and state grant process," end quote. Established in 1946 and dedicated to Ward County's first World War II casualty, Roy Hurd, this airport covers an area of 277 acres at an elevation of 2,614 feet above sea level. As the only airport in Ward County, it features two lighted runways, each measuring 4,920 feet in length and 75 feet in width, and has 18 occupied hangars. Over the past 5 years, Roy Hurd Memorial Airport has undergone a remarkable transformation. Beginning in 2020, the airport embarked on a journey of improvements, starting with a complete reconstruction of the main runway, ensuring safer and smoother takeoffs and landings for travelers. Followed by a complete interior remodel followed, enhancing pilot comfort, safety, and flight readiness. The momentum continued into 2022 as the airport dedicated efforts to seal cracks on three runways, minimizing hazards and ensuring optimal runway conditions. Simultaneously, the final phase of upgrading the fuel station was completed, featuring longer hoses, credit card availability, LED lighting, and a state-of-the-art fuel truck. The airport's commitment to improvement persisted into 2023 with the installation of a metal roof for durability and protection against the elements. Additionally, a carport was constructed for airport courtesy cars, enhancing accessibility and convenience. Looking ahead to 2024, Roy Hurd Memorial Airport continues its journey of progress. Plans are underway to seal cracks on the crosswind runway, ensuring continued safety and functionality. Furthermore, metal siding will wrap the terminal, enhancing its appearance, weather resilience, and a vision of an aircraft maintenance hangar, which will increase the availability of services provided at the airport.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.